watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. I'd like to wish you a happy new year. It's going to be a hard road to go for lovers of freedom and truth. But if we want these things to prevail, the most important resolution we can make is that we won't take no for an answer, that we'll do what it takes and not give up, even if we now have no idea of what that means. This week's show will be devoted to two presentations given by Professor Peter Dale Scott at the 9/11 Truth Conference last summer in Vancouver. His topics are 9/11 in the context of his lifelong research into what he calls deep politics and the deep state, and the role of 9/11 in wars of empire and what is termed continuity of government. That's a plan first hatched during the Reagan administration to install a dictatorship during a crisis. Some of the key planners involved with continuity of government were then Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. We'll set the stage with a clip from the Mike Malloy Show on Nova M Radio Network, from the day of Benazir Bhutto's assassination.
As a U.S. citizen involved in global madness that is our lot right now, all I could think of was the assassination of the Austrian Archduke Ferdinand and the events that transpired after his assassination, leading to World War I, which led to World War II, which led to on and on and on. World War II actually was Act Two of the war to end all wars. The assassination of Benazir Bhutto has been about the only story out there today, and for once I tend to agree with the supervising producers and editors in television who decided to make this the number one story, because the implications of this are unknowable right now, but they will be profoundly important to us. Oh, good evening. This is the Malloy Program on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Sir David Frost, who hosts a program called Frost Over the World, it's a current affairs program broadcast on Al Jazeera Television Network, the English language section, and it comes from London. David Frost interviewed former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto on November 2nd, not 2 months ago, about who she thought was behind the deadly bombing of her convoy when she arrived in Karachi, Pakistan, in October. That was the first assassination attempt against her. In that attempt, of course, you remember, over 100 people died and scores were wounded. I want to play that for you right now because I want you to hear this interview. There's a twist in it that I think you'll find astonishing. Listen to this.
I wrote to General Musharraf. I received information from General Musharraf that a friendly country had passed on to them the information that I could be attacked by a gang from the Afghan warlord Baitullah Masood, or by Hamza bin Laden, the son of Osama bin Laden, or by the Pakistani Taliban in Islamabad, or by a group in Karachi. So I sent back a letter saying that while these groups may be used, I thought it was more important to go after the people who supported them, who organized them, who could possibly be the financiers or the organizers of the finance for those groups. And I named three individuals who I thought were their sympathizers. Now, I understand that I could be wrong and my suspicions could be misplaced. But these are the people that I suspect want to stop the restoration of democracy. They want to stop my return because they know in 1993, when Pakistan was on the brink of being declared a terrorist state, I stopped the rise of terrorism. And they know that I can do it again.
In terms of these three people that you mentioned, were they members of or associated with the government?
Yes, well, one of them is a very key figure in security. He's a former military officer. He's someone that has had dealings with Jaish-e-Mohammed, one of the banned groups, with Maulana Azhar, who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists and three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, I know that having dealings with people does not necessarily mean direct evidence, but I also know that internal security has totally collapsed in Pakistan and that internal security cannot collapse without there being some blind eye, if not collusion, being turned to the rise of the militants and militancy.
Now, you may have heard it, but in case you didn't, we want to play this little bit of audio again, and I want you to hear it one more time.
And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden.
The man who murdered Osama bin Laden. What? Can you do it one more time, Kathy? The man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, who's this coming from? Is this coming from a caller to this program? No. Is it coming from me? No. Is it coming from a talk show host? No. Who's it coming from? It's coming from a woman who arguably knew more about the events, the intrigues, the politics, the lies, the deceits in that part of the world than any other human on earth and was willing to talk about it. One more time.
And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden.
The man who murdered Osama bin Laden. The man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Do you understand what the now dead Benazir Bhutto said? I mean, it takes a second to sink in. You want to think to yourself, well, the tape has been doctored. No, it hasn't. We went to Al Jazeera and looked at it. You can tell by the way her mouth moves. For some reason, it just blew right by David Frost. But there sat, 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago, Benazir Bhutto talking about the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, to the events of today. This raises the question, does it not, as to who was behind her assassination. She named three or four different groups that she felt were direct threats to her. People connected to the ISI, the secret service in Pakistan. Musharraf himself. But there's one element that she left out. And that would be people in the West who do not want to see Musharraf gone. He's very easy to deal with. We have multi-billion dollar investment in him. No wonder Bush keeps saying Musharraf is such a strong ally in the war on terror. Maybe Musharraf's people have already murdered Osama bin Laden. And if that's true, if Benazir Bhutto was telling the truth, obviously the Bush crime family is aware of it. Now, interestingly, this piece of video, and it's a 17-minute long interview with David Frost. It's out there. It's available. In all the coverage today, on all the cable networks, on the over-the-air networks, everywhere, and I will guarantee you tomorrow in the Times and the Post, there will not be a mention of this bit of tape what Benazir Bhutto said to David Frost November 6th last, in referencing one of the people she thought might be after her to kill her, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. The man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Are there two Osama bin Ladens? Is she referring to someone else? Astonishing. Absolutely astonishing.
Our next presenter is Peter Dale Scott. The book that I'm familiar with is Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. And I didn't know there was a Deep Politics 2 as well. Drugs, Oil, and War in 2003. 9/11 and the American Empire, Intellectuals Speak Out, edited by David Ray Griffin. And that's from Olive Branch Press. Project Censored has got top 25 censored stories. Peter Dale Scott's article, Homeland Security Contracts for Vast New Detention Camps. Then the forthcoming book called The Road to 9/11. And the subtitle is Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. And it looks like University of California Press publishing that. So please help me welcome fellow Canadian Peter Dale Scott.
This point came up about shouldn't we call the military-industrial complex the military-industrial-financial complex? I actually do exactly that in the first chapter of my book. And to go back to a bit of history, when Eisenhower made this astonishing speech that nobody predicted or expected about the warning against the military-industrial complex, he was referring to what was then a kind of faction in the American capitalist system that was threatening to destabilize the working Eisenhower Republican coalition between the big corporations and the big unions, and was relatively stable based on relatively low defense budgets, heavy reliance on atomic weapons to terrify everybody and not much else. And so you had a situation which I wrote about, and I said it was the CIA financial establishment being threatened then by the military-industrial complex. And my book, The Road to 9/11, is essentially a history of how in the 1970s, with the crisis of Vietnam, the CFR, which represented that CIA financial establishment, tried to scale down the war in order to preserve what was left of the old coalition. And essentially they lost, and you had a new generation of people came in. Rumsfeld and Cheney were at the seat of power in the Ford White House in 1975. And so since then, the distinction between the civilian economy and the military economy has pretty well vanished, because the old civilian economy, automobiles, etc., has pretty well gone down the tubes, and what is left is aircraft armaments, so that you see people come up, they're in the army, and then they go and do a stint with Grumman or McDonnell Douglas, and then they end up being in Lehman Brothers, so that the two have become one. And essentially, and of course, they've contributed to this enormous increasing disparity of wealth between the very rich and the very poor. Until that's turned around, you're not going to get democracy anywhere, not in America, not here. The whole key depends on reversing this increasing disparity between the wealth and the poor. It has happened in American history before, and hopefully it can happen again, but it's not going to be easy. And what we're doing here today is a very small little part of the effort to try and do that. And I've decided that it's really very important to compare these different events that break in on history. I call them deep events. And what I mean by a deep event is an event which it happens and everybody knows that we're not getting the full story to what happened. There's a depth there that takes maybe decades to explore. An obvious one being the assassination of President Kennedy, which we're still investigating. Another obvious one being 9/11. We don't even know who were the Arabs on the planes, for example, because the initial list we were given turned out to be one which even the head of the FBI said, well, we have some problems here. Now, the government has since forgotten about the problems, but the problems remain. And I'd like to add another one in between, Watergate, another deep event. When I say Watergate, a deep event, I mean the break-in. Collective memory about Watergate in the American history books is Nixon did it, he was guilty, he's gone, hooray for America. I'm talking about the break-in, which Nixon certainly did not do because it was carefully designed to be acutely embarrassing to Nixon and to bring out all the other secret illegal things that Nixon was doing. And that is still unknown and has some very marked similarities, including similarities of personnel to the identities of personnel with the Kennedy assassination. So those three in particular are of interest to me. There are other deep events which 9/11 students should look at, like the Oklahoma City bombing, for example. There are points of overlap between Oklahoma City and 9/11. The so-called 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, was very close with somebody who was quite intensely investigated in 1995 because of his connection to Oklahoma City. All of that has been pretty well buried in the press, and so it's important also to look at Oklahoma City. But I'm not going to talk about it today because the three events that I'm talking about, JFK, Watergate break-in, and 9/11, are events which officially were committed by very tiny marginal people like Lee Harvey Oswald, but which had immense consequences for American history. The displacement, the killing of one president, the forced resignation of another president, and virtually the suspension of the American Constitution, Bill of Rights, habeas corpus, all because of 19 Arabs. One other deep event I could talk about is Contragate, which is half in and half out. No president resigned because of Contragate in 1986, but if you remember, the head of the CIA, William Casey, promptly died very mysteriously of cancer in a matter of days, very much like Jack Ruby. And it was at a time when Reagan was beginning to frighten some people because he was very much warming up to Gorbachev and threatening, and to some extent successfully threatening, the end of the Cold War, which had supported the military-industrial complex for four decades. So Contragate was very close to displacing a president, and certainly weakened him and certainly forced him to revise his surrounding cabinet and so on. But I will talk about these three events that really do, first of all, share the significance of having changed history officially according to very small people, but these are deep events and we know that there is more to the death of Kennedy than the troubled story of Lee Harvey Oswald. And so we have not only deep events, but we have something that I call now deep history, that along with our mainstream history, which we read about every day in the papers, from time to time we are reminded that there is a deep history of America, which can almost be defined by what you cannot read about in the mainstream papers, and it's becoming easier and easier to learn about because of the Internet. And the official stories are the stories in the mainstream press. And it's amazing the difference between the mainstream press and the Internet. So we're getting two different realms of discourse here. One which can talk about deep history. And then I'm going to throw in another word, another concept here, the deep state, which is the part of the state which does not report to Congress, does not have to be publicly accountable. It's definitely there. The most obvious example is, of course, the CIA. and what it does secretly with drug traffickers is going to be the main theme of my talk today, is the importance of drug traffickers in all three of the events that I'm talking about here. The word deep state is not my invention. It comes from Turkey, and the term became absolutely widely current in Turkey a few years ago when there was a huge car crash in a place called Susurluk. And in the car, you had a member of parliament, a police chief, a beauty queen, and her lover, who was the top Turkish gangster at the time, a man called Abdullah Katli, who was also the head of the one of the top drug traffickers in Turkey. Well, that's a perfect paradigm for the deep state. You've got people in government. Oh, and by the way, this drug trafficker had a diplomatic passport in his name signed by the Minister of the Interior. Well, it's absolutely beautiful way to remember what the deep state is. And the term started in Turkey, but it was picked up by a very intelligent Norwegian political scientist who I've since got to know, Ola Tunander, who's in that anthology that I edited with David Ray Griffin, Intellectuals Speak Out. And he thinks that this underlying conflict between the public state, which is responsible to people elected and so on, struggling with the deep state, which is none of those things, entirely top-down, not accountable to anybody, that is the main problem, according to him and according to me, in American politics and to a great degree in world politics today. I mean, this problem is not confined to America. It's proportional to the amount of power you exert in the world, and particularly the extent to which you project your power into other parts of the world. The deep state is responsible for that projection of power. So that's why deep events are important to me, because underlying them, it's not like you had a freak episode over here and another freak episode over there. No, you have a deep state that from time to time breaks into the regular politics of the country and does so in alliance with its proxies, or what Webster last night called the patsies, who are outside the system. Now, I'd like to make another similarity, which I think is extremely important. Investigations of the subject, of the suspects, the people who would be fingered, were interrupted and impeded and interfered with in the weeks leading up to the key event. It's rather simple to say this about Lee Harvey Oswald, and a very brilliant paper was given on this by my friend John Newman a couple of years ago. Lee Harvey Oswald went to the Soviet Union in 1959. He was put on something called the watch list. In other words, they were supposed to pay special attention to what he was doing. And if only they'd been paying special attention to what he was doing in the last month before the assassination, it might not have happened the way it happened, because Lee Harvey Oswald suddenly went into high gear, was handing out Fair Play for Cuba leaflets. According to the CIA cables, he went down to Mexico, and according to some of the witnesses in Mexico, started talking about assassinations with a top KGB assassination expert. Well, with all of this going on, the man should have been called in, possibly arrested, certainly interviewed. If that had happened, he could not have been called a disgruntled loner who suffered because no one paid him any attention. In fact, the government was paying a lot of attention to Lee Harvey Oswald in the 6 weeks before the assassination. But, and this is the amazing thing, they took him off the watch list. On October the 2nd, they took him off the watch list. Just when he becomes suspicious, they took him off the watch list. Why am I talking about this today? Because in the case of 9/11, you had, how many people know anything about Ali Mohammed, my favorite villain? Almost not very many people. Well, if there's time in this hour, I will come back to him at the end of my remarks. But here is a man who I think was a double agent. He was certainly an FBI informant. He had certainly been in U.S. Special Forces. He had certainly at one point been a CIA agent. And I think that the CIA says they washed their hands of him, but they always say they washed their hands of people just when they become interesting. If he wasn't a CIA agent, how was he, while still an active member of the U.S. Special Forces, able to go to Afghanistan and train people in Afghanistan and apparently actually take part in the Afghan War in 1988? He was an active member of the U.S. Special Forces. The laws are against that. His commander was very against it, but his commander was overruled. And I can only think of one explanation for that, because of the CIA. All right, but what else was he? Oh, this, by the way, this brings in Vancouver. Vancouver Airport, where I was yesterday. In 1993, a known terrorist landed at Vancouver Airport and was promptly detained, and Ali Mohammed turned up and intervened for him, and the RCMP did something they shouldn't have done. They were getting out of line. They detained Ali Mohammed as well. This is in 1993. And Ali Mohammed said, "You don't want to detain me. Look, you just phone this number and you'll see that I'm to be released." And they phoned the number. It was the FBI in the United States. And they released him. And what did he do after that? He flew to Kenya. He photographed the U.S. embassy in Kenya, took the photos himself to Osama bin Laden, and bin Laden sort of marked it up with a crayon and said, "Put the truck here. That's the best place for the explosives." None of this is doubted, that a U.S. double agent was in charge of planning those bombings that happened in 1998 in Kenya. But it's worse than that. It's now since come out and not disputed that he himself told the FBI after 9/11 that he had been Al-Qaeda's top trainer in how to hijack airplanes. All right, so we have a U.S. double agent who was training Al-Qaeda in how to do it. He said, "I'm the one who told them to sit in first class near the pilots," and so on. This is not disputed. Well, the reason I'm mentioning him now is because most of you hadn't heard of him. The FBI was surveilling him in 1989, and then in 1990... one of the people that, well, it was actually three, but only one was arrested and convicted. One of the people that he had trained committed what has been called the first Al-Qaeda act of terror in America. This man's name was Nosair, and he murdered a not very attractive Jewish activist, Meir Kahan, and was arrested for the murder. And everybody immediately said, "Oh, Nosair did it." And these are actual quotes here that he did it, but he was a lone deranged gunman. They had actually picked up the other two co-conspirators. They knew that the getaway car he was supposed to leave in had been moved so it wouldn't get ticketed in New York. So they knew there were conspirators. They went to his house and they found volumes of incriminating evidence, including a primitive version of the Al-Qaeda terrorist handbook, which had come, Ali Mohammed had supplied it from Special Forces at Fort Bragg. They found plans for public buildings, which were subsequently, including the World Trade Center, which was bombed by his disciples in 1993, They didn't pick up those people because the FBI terminated the surveillance before the first crime was committed in 1989. This is, when we're talking about how these things are done, this termination of surveillance, taking people off the watch list, is very important. And to come back to the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, should have been investigated. They should have known much more, probably detained them. And they couldn't. And the reason given was they said, well, there was a wall built between terrorist investigations and criminal investigations. This is a rather complicated matter. The Republicans made a great noise about how it was the Democrats who introduced this. But the Deputy Attorney General, and what was his name? He wasn't Andrew Marshall. Anyway, Andrew Thompson, had renewed the wall on, I think, August 2nd, 2001, because they didn't want these people to be picked up before 9/11. They were necessary to have them not being surveilled, able to be blamed. I'm not going to get in who was really on those planes, but it was important to be able to blame these 19 people. And so they renewed the rules which made it difficult to go after. The Mousawi should have been picked up, and he knew some of the others. It could have unraveled the whole thing before 9/11, and that, would, of course, is not what the designers of 9/11 had in mind. So this suspension of surveillance just before the event, although a bit difficult to describe, is extremely important. And I'll give one other comparison between JFK and 9/11 before I get to what I really want to talk about. And that is eventually both are investigated by a commission. The commission looks into it and finds that the alleged culprits acted alone, and then draws a very complete non sequitur conclusion. They acted alone, but it's particularly extraordinary in the case of Oswald. Oswald acted alone, therefore we have to increase our surveillance of organized groups. Well, what kind of logic is that? But that's what the Warren Commission recommended. Increase the power of the deep state was the recommendation. And particularly, they said the CIA should have the power to tap into FBI and FBN and other domestic intelligence records. So it was building the power, the centralized power of the deep state. And 9/11 Commission, same thing. The mistakes were made. Maybe they should not have backed these people in the past. But we have to increase the power of these people who made the mistakes. And so that, too, I think, the increasing powers being given to the deep state, when the problem is the deep state, that is something which was contributed to by both commissions. So are you with me so far? Good. Now, here's something I talked about last time, but it's so important, I'm going to talk about it again. The immediate identification of the culprits. In Dallas in 1963, within 15 minutes of the assassination, and long before Oswald had been picked up in the Texas theater, they put out on the police network a description of the man they were looking for. And they said he's 5'10", he's 165 pounds. This is allegedly based on a description given by a witness who later said, well, I saw a man in a window and I saw him from here up. Well, if you see a man from here up, how do you know he's 5'10 and weighs 165 pounds? It's not a very credible story. What is interesting is two things. First of all, 5'10", 165 pounds is exactly the description of Oswald in FBI file. Exactly the description of Lee Harvey Oswald in CIA cables a month before the assassination. And now we come to the other interesting thing. It wasn't the height and it wasn't the weight of the man picked up in Dallas, who was 5'9" and about 100, somewhere between 100 and
45.
Yeah, usually 145. There's a lot of difference between 145 and 165. And yet they had that identification within 15 minutes. Now, why am I mentioning this? Because in Richard Clark's book, according to Richard Clark, the FBI already had a list of the alleged hijackers by 9:59 a.m. on September the 11th. Well, the fourth plane hadn't even hit the ground yet. at that time. So this is remarkable detective work on the part of the FBI, which later said, well, we weren't doing a very good job on following these terrorists because that's not really our job. Well, they did a good enough job to come up with the list of the people who were going to be blamed almost immediately. And Webster made a big issue about this last night. He said, well, how did Richard Clark know it was Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden? Well, the answer is, according to his book, and I actually believe him on, I don't believe Richard Clark on everything. He was the terrorist czar and certainly contributed to COG, change of government, which I think is the deep story underlying 9/11. But I believe Clark when he says that I learned it was Osama bin Laden from a call from the FBI at 9:59 a.m. And they said, we have a list of the traffic, of the people on the plane. And Clark actually makes a very intelligent comment at this point. He said, I wasn't surprised that they were Al-Qaeda, but I was very surprised that they used their own names to get on the plane. Because the Al-Qaeda modus operandi is to always use a pseudonym. But they made things very easy for Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and the FBI and everybody. They made an exception to this rule on 9/11 and all went and got on the planes using their own identification. Unless you agree with me that the people who got on the planes were using somebody else's identification, which explains why so many of these people, at least six and maybe more, shortly after 9/11 said, yeah, that's me, that's my history. One or two cases said, that's my photograph, but wasn't me on the plane because here I am still alive in another country. So again, I think this is extremely important, and this relates to the Martin Luther King assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, that they've already decided in advance who's going to be blamed for it. They know in advance who they are going to blame for it. And that is a suggestion that these things are not happening outside the structure of the deep state, but that the deep state itself is involved in these events. The big stuff is the recurrence of drug traffickers in all of these events. And it's not because drug traffickers rule the world. It's because drug traffickers are used by the deep state when they want to exert power in parts of the world where Congress is not likely to vote them funds. So that's why, for example, the CIA helped establish the drug traffickers in Burma after World War II. And when Burma got very upset and pushed them out, they then worked with them in Laos instead. And, that could be an interesting story in itself, but we don't have time for it. In the case of the JFK assassination, Watergate, Contragate, and now 9/11, the deep state worked with assets outside civil society and beyond the rule of law. Yes, you have to work with criminals. The people, the suits, as we call them, the people who sit in offices in the Pentagon and Langley, the CIA, they don't want to be caught doing some dirty trick. You get somebody else to do it. So I'm going to repeat this important hypothesis again, that in JFK, Watergate, Contragate, and I will come to 9/11, the deep state worked with assets outside civil society and beyond the rule of law. Now, before I get into this, because this is not being conceded yet in the case of 9/11, but I want to point out that in every preceding event, this was initially strongly denied, and then as the evidence accumulated over the years, it was reluctantly conceded to be the case. Take the example of Jack Ruby. The Warren Report spent quite a few pages in order to persuade people that Jack Ruby was a no-count nobody, just like Lee Harvey Oswald, with no real connection, and specifically not connected to organized crime. They knew this because they went to the head, among other things they did, the FBI went to the head of organized crime in Chicago. And he said, was he part of the mob? And these top people said, no, he's not part of the mob. And that's in the footnotes to the Warren Report. But in 1979, the House Assassinations Committee assembled a report of over 1,000 pages on his organized crime connections. So it's not in question now. Yes, he was connected to organized crime. He was actually more important than just organized crime. He was the go-between between organized crime and particularly drug trafficking in Dallas and the Dallas police. More than one Dallas detective said, yes, I knew Jack Ruby. I knew him because, and one of them said it to me personally on the phone, he was my top informant on drug trafficking. And that's sort of how the status quo works, or worked back then in a city like Dallas. They had to arrest a few people every now and then. Jack Ruby would help them arrest, shall we say, the right people, meaning not the big-time people. And particularly relevant, I think, is the Assassinations Committee heard from a close ally of Jack Ruby. Ruby, of course, was dead. But they heard from his associate, Lewis McWillie, that in 1959, the two men had visited the Trescornia prison camp in Cuba, where Santo Traficante was the top drug trafficker in the region. And this is a quote from McWillie, the primary reason, close quote, for the visit was to meet Giuseppe DeGeorge. Well, the Assassinations Committee left it at that. They didn't tell us who Giuseppe DeGeorge is. But if you go to Federal Bureau of Narcotics records, Giuseppe DeGeorge was one of the two top heroin couriers between Europe and Cuba. Since Deep Politics, in a piece I have on the Mary Farrell Foundation website or the History Matters website where I talk about Mexico, one of these stories that said that Oswald was, the witness said that Oswald had been paid, can you imagine this being taken seriously? It was taken very seriously. That somebody in front of the Cuban consulate, not even inside, in front of the Cuban consulate gave $6,500 to Lee Harvey Oswald to kill President Kennedy. This was taken seriously in Washington. J. Edgar Hoover had a special phone call to Lyndon Johnson about it on November the 29th. It was an essential part of what I call the Phase 1, Phase 2 strategy of setting up the Warren Commission. You have a story which is a false story, but a credible story saying that Oswald was working for Cuba or working for the Soviet Union. And this is Johnson's reason to set up the Warren Commission. He said, we face World War III if we don't stop these false stories. Well, the witness who supplied this necessary false story, Gilberto Alvarado, was a Nicaraguan. And in the documents that have flooded out in the last decade, we learned that he reported directly to General Gustavo Montiel, the chief of the intelligence service of the Nicaraguan army. Well, that's the National Guard in Nicaragua, up to here in narcotics. He was actually identified as being part of a stolen car ring, but the head of the stolen car ring, a man called Norman Meneses, that Gary Webb wrote about in his book Dark Alliance, was described, and these are in CIA cables, so there's no debate about it, as the kingpin of narcotics traffickers in Nicaragua. So that's what I mean about you dig deeper into the Kennedy story and you find the necessary deep role being played by people with connections to the drug traffic. I've just finished a draft essay on Watergate, on the break-in, as preparation for this talk to reassure myself that what I remembered is true. And I argue in this paper that the Watergate burglars assembled by Howard Hunt, all but one of whom were Cubans, and at least two of whom had direct connections to the drug traffic in Cuba under Batista, were used under White House direction to restructure the drug traffic by eliminating and probably, sorry, I have to say possibly, but I think probably, even assassinating old-time drug traffickers who formed part of the so-called French Connection. Nixon was, I think, sincerely, we can say bad things about Nixon, I certainly have all my life, but he sincerely wanted to do something about the flood of heroin coming into America. It was chiefly coming from Vietnam because of our involvement in Vietnam. He took that on eventually, but as a first stage, he took on the French Connection, heroin that was being processed in labs in Marseille and being brought in until Castro took over. It was brought in through my hometown of Montreal and Havana. And with Castro taking over, it put much... There's a very good book called The Canadian Connection, which is all about drugs reaching America either through Montreal or through Mexico, and the Mexican drugs coming in 1963 through the city of Dallas. It's all in this book, The Canadian Connection, by a Canadian. According to Edward Epstein, Hunt contacted a number of Cuban exiles and had explained that he had been authorized by the White House to recruit Cuban exiles into hit teams, which would be used ostensibly, that's Epstein's word, ostensibly to assassinate narcotics dealers. Well, you're assembling an assassination squad in the White House. Now, I can't prove it to you today, but my hypothesis is that Howard Hunt was a double agent, that he was... Nixon thought he was working for Nixon. The drug trade thought he was working for the drug trade. And the drug trade survived this onslaught on the French Connection. And lo and behold, in the wake of what happened in Watergate, you have a reconstructed drug trafficking under the control of three young Cubans, one of whom, a man called Cecilia Falcón, gets to be in power in Mexico after the leading French Connection man in Mexico, Sarti, has been murdered. And we still don't know, but some people think murdered by Hunt's Cubans, so that the drug trade is the deep story underlying the activities of Hunt's Cuban burglars in 1972. And I could go on and on. But I will just say, if 9/11 is similar to these preceding events, and I believe it is, we have to face the possibility that forces within the American deep state were again allied with drug traffickers. Well, in this case, the drug traffickers would be Al-Qaeda. And what we would be looking at in 9/11 was not just simply an act by Al-Qaeda, nor, let me say, in my opinion, simply an act by Cheney in the White House, but the product of this interaction between the deep state in power and their allies or proxies in the drug trade. Now, for me to say that, I'm saying, as nearly all the world says, that Al-Qaeda was deeply involved in drug trafficking. But when we go to the 9/11 Commission report, it turns out that they don't believe this. And I'm going to read an amazing sentence from the 9/11 Commission report. I think you could impeach the whole bona fides of the report by this one sentence. While the drug trade was a source of income for the Taliban, it did not serve the same purpose for Al-Qaeda. There is no reliable evidence that bin Laden was involved in or made his money through drug trafficking. That's lawyers' language, where they say bin Laden. Yes, I don't know that bin Laden was out there selling coke on the street corner, but Al-Qaeda, there was plenty of available evidence that Al-Qaeda was involved in drug trafficking. Let me read to you first what Tony Blair told the British Parliament on October 4th, 2001, Al-Qaeda's activity includes substantial exploitation of the drug trade from Afghanistan. The report came out, the 9/11 report came out in July of 2004. Perhaps the next issue of Time magazine, August the 2nd, 2004, has a major story about the drug traffic. It's a major story, and I'm quoting from Time now. Haji Juma Khan, the kingpin of a heroin trafficking enterprise that is a principal source of funding for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda terrorists. According to a Western anti-narcotics official, since slipping out of Afghanistan after U.S. forces released him, that's another thing Cheney has to answer for, by the way, but I don't have time to explain how. Cheney would not let the U.S. forces go in to surround Tora Bora. He trusted a local drug trafficker. Amazingly, the drug trafficker let bin Laden escape. Who could have imagined such a thing would happen? Khan has helped al-Qaeda establish a smuggling network that is peddling Afghan heroin to buyers across the Middle East, Asia, and Europe, and in turn is using the drug revenues to purchase weapons and explosives. That, I think, is the true story. Now, what the report said, no evidence, was after U.S. Central Command reported that in December 2003, an Arab sailing vessel was intercepted near the Strait of Hormuz carrying almost 2 tons of hashish valued at up to $10 million. There were, quote, clear ties, close quote, between the shipment and al-Qaeda, the CENTCOM statement said. So when they say there's no credible evidence, they're ignoring what came from CENTCOM. And by the way, that wasn't the only such ship, but I learned this quite recently, but the Time article on August 2nd referred to another ship which was detained after the CENTCOM statement on New Year's Eve. A U.S. Navy vessel in the Arabian Sea stopped a small fishing boat that was carrying no fish. After a search, a Western anti-narcotics official said, and this is a quote from an anti-narcotics official, they found several al-Qaeda guys sitting on a bale of drugs. Well, what's interesting here, if the evidence is so blatant and coming from such official sources, why does the 9/11 Commission go out on a limb with a statement which is not going to bear the scrutiny of history, that there is no reliable evidence, their words, no reliable evidence for linking al-Qaeda to the drug traffic? Because I think it's important for their story is that al-Qaeda is self-standing, not related to the drug traffic, because people in the inside know that the drug traffic is related to the American deep state. It's very important to put out to the American people, the Canadian people, and the world that there is something terribly wrong about the official story of thing. And it should have been investigated before it was ever used as an excuse to attack a country. And it will be even more important if it's used again for Congress to investigate it before it is used to attack a country. Now, this is not easy going, because we don't, let's face it, us in the room, have a great deal of power over the mass media. We do have some influence in the internet, but that's limited influence. We don't have ready ears in the Democratic majority in Congress waiting for something like this. It's going to take a lot of work to persuade them that this is something that needs to be done. But it is important, I think, to get the case. Now, I just would come back to one last thing, which I don't have time to explore in length. Oswald, I'm sure, was a double agent, that there were Cubans at the time of great concern to John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, Alpha 66, because Kennedy was trying to stave off nuclear confrontation with Khrushchev by promising no attacks on Cuba based in the United States. And he's put a lot of effort into trying to make that promise stick. Alpha 66 was dedicated to breaking that promise, not just attacking Cuba from the United States, but they were attacking Soviet vessels, which was, in effect, trying to nullify the U.S.-Soviet agreement and reopen the case for invading Cuba. Oswald was linked to Alpha 66 in Dallas. And he was, if that's true, as I think it is, he was a double agent. And what I suspect, he was a double agent who maybe had more sympathy with Alpha 66 than he did with the FBI or whoever he was supposed to be reporting to. And I don't have time to get into my long Ali Mohammed spiel, but it is on the internet. It is, I think, very interesting that you have a man recruited as a brought to this country on a special visa, which he was not eligible for. He must have been on the CIA special list to break the rules to get him into the country. And he is training al-Qaeda, not just in, to blow up embassies in Kenya, which nobody denies, but in how to hijack airplanes. He was clearly involved in the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, or at least all the people he trained in how to bomb were the people who did it. But they didn't want, oh no, more important to have an agent in there because then we know what's going on. This is the kind of corruption. By the way, people's promotions depend on their ability to recruit agents. This is a very corrupting influence because they hang on to so-called agents who, in fact, are just thumbing their noses at the interests of the United States. If the American public is so aware of what's wrong with 9/11, why isn't Congress? Well, for one thing, very disappointing thing about the Democratic National Committee in 2006 is that they ran candidates against the people who were most likely to have made an issue of 9/11 in Congress. You have to ask Rahm Emanuel and Charles Schumer why they were so dedicated to stopping the... I suspect the influence of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Political Affairs Committee, because, let's face it, AIPAC wants an attack on Iran because they want Israel to have the unchallenged dominance of the region. Let me be clear about what I want here, and I'll be clearer tomorrow. I don't think we're ready to impeach anybody. I think it would be an actual mistake to put a lot of weight into an impeachment resolution now because we know it would fail. What we're ready for and we have the evidence for is a case to reopen the investigation of 9/11 and lead up to an interrogation for the first time ever under oath of Dick Cheney. Now that we are ready for. And that's something Kucinich is ready for. It's not something that the Democratic Party is ready for. How many people have heard of Sybil Edmonds? Good, good. Well, she could be the key to this whole thing because, you know, here is a former FBI translator who tried to alert the government to what she says was a massive heroin-based conspiracy inside the government corrupting Congress. In fact, specifically when there was a supportive article in Vanity Fair, which is pretty important because you're beginning to break into the mainstream here. There was a story about her in Vanity Fair which repeated her charge, which has not led to a libel suit, that money from this thing was reaching Dennis Hastert, who was the Republican Speaker of the Congress. It really involves Pakistan. It's the same story. There was going to be a section of the 9/11 report that was a severe criticism of Pakistan, but Pakistan threw a lot of money around Congress and got it taken out of the 9/11 report. So the corruption is there. And a lot of us thought, well, when the Democrats get elected, finally a Democratic committee will investigate Sybil Edmonds' charges. And the candidate for this was Henry Waxman, because he's chair of the House Government Reform Oversight and Reform Committee. It's the appropriate place for it. So there's been a very intensive internet campaign to send emails, send letters, send phone calls to Henry Waxman. Has not answered a single email, has not answered a single phone call. So I think we don't have two horses in this race. We only have Dennis Kucinich. Encourage him. If America can, or Canada, the world can prove that there's an interest in this, that becomes grist to Kucinich's mill. He wants to do it, but he can't get Congress to go along with him. He had a press conference on this, and he was absolutely derided for it for all the wrong ad hominem reasons. I think it was O'Reilly or some of these right-wing commentators, they commented on he's a very short man.
So that's where we are, which is not very far along. But if we believe in democracy, if we believe that ultimately the American people will get the truth, the only way we can help them to get the truth is to keep struggling to get the truth out there and to use vehicles like a congressional investigation of what happened.
You've been listening to Professor Peter Dale Scott speaking last summer at the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Conference.